I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
I know the consequences. We won't see each other anymore, but that's life.
That doesn't mean we can't see each other at work, does it?
We'll see each other, but if you want your marriage to work, we can't be close friends. You gotta treat me like one of the gang. You greet me just like any one of the guys. You say, "Hi, Mel. Hi, Mulligan. Hi, Bentley. Hi, Harry."
I can't do that.
You can do it. Try it.
All right. "Hi, Mel. Hi, Mulligan. Hi, Bentley. Hi, Harry."
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the 1962 classic situation comedy, I'm Dickens, He's Fenster. Arch Fenster himself, Marty Ingalls, will join us to help navigate this particular excursion into the annals of classic television. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages. Today on the TV Time Machine, we are proud to welcome an entertainment legend, actor, comedian, and businessman extraordinaire, Marty Ingalls. For over 50 years, Mr. Ingalls' comic gifts have tickled the funny bones of millions of television viewers, particularly as Arch Fenster in the sweet and slapsticky 1960s sitcom about two bumbling construction crew buddies, I'm Dickens, He's Fenster. Our guest is also a talented voice artist and is probably best known for being the voice behind the 1980s animated TV classic, Pac-Man. Over the next few segments, the hilarious Marty Ingalls will not only help us explore virtually every aspect of I'm Dickens, He's Fenster, but will also discuss what it's like having to sign his name on hundreds of tiny little postcards. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to apply for a building permit, feel free to grab your hammer and shovel as we slip from the restraints of the present and enter a groundbreaking past. Marty, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
You say that, huh?
I do.
Okay, if you don't, I'll be very upset, you know.
Well, Marty, what I'm going to do is I'm going to slide into my Ralph Edwards role.
Don't tell me. I need prepare. We're going to operate now. Now, you'll be in a twilight position. You won't be out, but you'll be close.
Well, you grew up in New York. Now, specifically Brooklyn. Now,
some people argue with whether or not I am fully grown, but New York did it for me. When I left, I said, the minute I saw two palm trees, I said, this is it. You know, but it's funny how you miss it. You go back because that's where the roots are in the culture, and that's where the memories, you know, Hollywood doesn't provide much of that, you know. So go on, I'm starting to cry. Go on.
Do you think growing up in Brooklyn made you a better comedian?
You know, it could be the dumbest question. No. That is a great question. No one's ever asked me that. Because one would say that coming from the poor section of town anywhere makes you a good comedian because comedy comes from negative. You know, comedy comes in. You know what they say. The caliber of your character is fashioned by the ashes of your adversity. And that's very interesting. I fight with Shirley all the time about that because I say that great contributions of all kinds come from pain. She says no. But I do think so. Does Brooklyn, back to your question, equate to having tough times? Yeah. But I think any tough times is a good place for comedy. Brooklyn made me a New York character, and people respond to New York characters. They're funny, and they're ethnic, and they're stuff like that. The comedy came from the fact that I had a big gaping hole in my heart because I didn't wasn't loved enough and didn't have the proper kind of family, so self-esteem didn't happen, so I had to create another language, and that's what comedians do. They all come, they come from a place of suffering and a lack of enough love, so they have to go out and find it somewhere, and they sit in a room, like some people sat in a room and learned how to play the guitar and became Johnny Cash. Other guys just looked around on how to make people respond to them because they weren't getting it the right way. And I lived in the perfect shadow of my brother Arthur, who could do everything. Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude. He was a football quarterback, and he was beautiful. My God, and I dropped out of everything he could do. Well, that was everything I just mentioned. There was nothing left, except he wasn't funny. So I filled in as a contractor goes into a house and he could tell you where the structure is in the roof, and a decorator coming in the house and tell you what color's missing. A comic goes into a room and he can pick out, you know, the cat's too fat and the host that never shaves and lady drinks too much and, you know, it's raining inside. So, you know, that's the longest answer to the shortest question. And I'm already nauseous. Okay, so, you know, Brooklyn is a great place to be from. And when I go back, I'm afraid to get out of the car most of the time. But I do go back.
Well, Marty, you mentioned that Dick Van Dyke praised...
He's a real interesting career type. He was brilliant. Boy, everything about him. But he didn't make it in the movies like he should have. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's done two or three of the biggest box office.
Right.
But they were that Me Do Chitty Chitty. That one, I think that was his. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Was that him?
Right. Well, he praised I'm Dickens, He's Fenster. Now, you were on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and we have a clip here that we'll play right now.
No, not that girl. Not that girl, Sarge. You're going to waste your time with that girl, Sarge. She's as stuck up as they come, that girl.
What makes you think she's so stuck up?
Well, because I know her. I know that girl. I talked to her. I went right up to her, polite, like, nice. And I said to her, how do you do, sweetie? How about you and I taking a hop down to the PX, and I'll spring for a couple of beers, and then if I'm not too drunk, then I'll heist a weapons carrier, and we'll take a spin around the obstacle course. You know, nice. Well, Sarge, that girl, stuck up, comes back with an answer that you'd never believe.
Well, what did she say?
She said, no, thank you.
Marty, how did you land that role on the Dick Van Dyke Show?
And how I landed it is a movie unto itself. I was sitting in the Pancake House way back when they first began. I was here at 3:00 in the morning with a date. You can only imagine what this date looked like at 3:00 in the morning at the Pancake House. I had about $3 on me. And I look over there, and who strolls in, believe it or not, was Sheldon Leonard and Carl Reiner and their wives.
Wow.
Well, I said, oh, my God. And she said, well, who's that? I said, who's that? That's probably the entire comedy industry is sitting right over there. I got to do something here. I asked her to lend me $2, and I had $5 now. So I went in the back, believe it or not, and I asked who's serving that table over there, and the girl came over. She said, me. I said, I'll give you $5 if you let me serve the dessert. How about that? So I waited for the dessert, and I came out. Well, I don't know. I did 85 minutes on the ice cream. 42 minutes on the cake, and the guys knew exactly what was going on.
Right.
The women weren't sure. They were giggling. You know, I'm a funny guy. So Carl took out a card and said, do me a favor. We'd like you to get the real ice cream, first of all. Here's my card. Come to see me tomorrow. He said that. And I went in. I don't know if you, I guess, thank God for things. I mean, look, I said things didn't happen to me, and look what I'm saying now, how wonderful this was. Anybody else would say. But he, when I went the next day, he said, you know, we're introducing a new character called Saul Pomerantz, and he's Dick's army buddy. Read it. Well, bingo. I mean, phew. I did two or three of them. I don't know. I should have done more. Go on. Are we through yet? No.
Well, just a few months after the Dick Van Dyke Show,
yes,
you were cast as the co-star of I'm Dickens, He's Fenster with John Astin, as we'll hear in the following clip.
Mel not here yet?
No.
Well, I better give him a call and tell him to hustle over here, huh?
Why should you be the one to tell him anything?
What's the matter with you? Pass the sugar.
What'd you say?
Pass the sugar.
Was that an order?
I said pass the sugar.
Uh-huh. You didn't say please pass the sugar. You didn't say Harry, pass the sugar. You didn't say Mr. Dickens, pass the sugar. You just said pass the sugar,
right? Yeah, I said pass the sugar.
Just as I thought. You're after my job.
Well, if your job is guarding the sugar, I'm after it.
Marty, for those in the audience who might not have seen...
That's so great.
For those in our audience who might not be familiar with I'm Dickens, He's Fenster, or, God forbid, have not purchased the DVD I'm Dickens, He's Fenster's on DVD, what is the premise of I'm Dickens, He's Fenster?
Well, it's about two priests in the Midwest.
In the Vatican.
No, it's about two guys who, you know, you could say it's Gleason and Carney in a way. It's two regular guys who happen to be construction guys, you know? One guy's married, and one guy's like a ladies' man. I always had the ladies in the show, and we had some pretty hot guest ladies there. So I had the real juicy part, you know, where we had scenes where I tried to romance the girl and everything went wrong. And I was always had tools, and the tools were going wrong. It was a very physical show. It was going to bring slapstick back. That's why I never felt at the time we were doing anything wonderful. But you know, I have a letter in my house from Stan Laurel. And boy, do I treasure that now. You know, they were broke for the most part and living in the actor's home. And he was an avid fan of our show, Stan Laurel. Well, to say we were a little bit Laurel and Hardy now, that's a legitimate thing to say, because Stan... So we were very much that, and they were building physical things, you know. You know, I'm building this bread box. Yeah, come look at it. Come look at it. You open the bread box, and a big thing pops out and hits you in the neck. It was very, very funny and great to be a comedian in that thing. And it's two guys, and Emmeline Henry, she could have gone on to be... Unfortunately, she died not too long after the show of a brain aneurysm, just very young. She was sensational. And, you know, all the guest stars we had, you know, the one from, we had Batgirl, who was on the show. The girl who played Batgirl.
Right, Yvonne Craig.
The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen Burstyn was on the show.
That's right.
Sally Kellerman was on the show. All my girlfriends. You know. No, they were all my girlfriends in the show, and it was great. I just wish this is like therapy for me. I wish I would have enjoyed it more. I was really obsessed, because I had no compunction about saying, John, wait a minute, don't lift it this way and then spill it there, because you don't see you. Watch, I'll show you how to do it. You lift it this way. See how much funnier that is? Well, I was right. It looked funnier. But everybody in the crew said, give me a break, you know?
Well, I was
telling you, John, you don't close the door that way. You have to close it this way. Watch, I show you. Watch. And then I do it naturally. I was red buttons, and I was doing it that way. And I look back on it now. Yes, I had, in the manner of speaking, I was broader and more slapsticky. John was an honest actor. And boy, that's what Jack Lemmon was. So we got along, because I was overwhelming, and you couldn't hate me, you know, but you could certainly dislike me intensely. because I was not them, humble and compassionate. And I give myself a right to have not been that because I was hungry for love, hungry for self-esteem. And you know those people can often, Buddy Hackett was, I guess, a great comic, but invite him to a party and you want to throw him out the window in 5 minutes. So that's the world of the comic.
Well, the executive producer
I have to take my underwear twice since I talked to you.
The executive producer and the creator of I'm Dickens, He's Fenster was Leonard Stern, who is probably best known in production circles as the executive producer of Get Smart. What was he like as a producer, both personally and professionally?
He scared the hell out of me. He was 9 feet tall with a beard. Nobody's 9 feet tall except with a beard, except the ghost of Christmas Past.
Or Lincoln.
I know, I was afraid of him, too. But Lincoln, at least you get depressed once in a while. Lenny was a father figure to me. It was very hard to get close to Lenny. He was not like Carl Reiner would rib you and talk and tell you a dirty joke. He was very stately, very handsome, you know, suiting a tie, black hair and a black beard. And he knew comedy from an executive. I never communed too much with him because he never, it was the director on the set, Norman Abbott, why that name just hits me. He was a director for a long time. And, you know, I had a big fight. Naturally, I have to have a fight with who did the pilot and went on to become a monumental director.
Arthur Hiller, right, who directed The In-Laws and Silver Street.
The only time in my whole life I ever walked off a set was the day that he came to direct. And he had to come to the dressing room and say, will you please come back to the set? He was a young director from Canada. Then he tells a story that I was difficult. So when he went on to do a movie with Doris Day and Gig Young, or who I'm trying to think of the movie, because now I'm giving the reason why maybe things didn't go that well for me. He hired John Astin to do that wonderful role in this movie he played a guy behind a counter, I think an unemployment guy, and she used to go to see him all the time. And I wondered why I didn't get it. Well, excuse me, Ingalls, you walked off the set and you made him conciliatory to come to your dressing room and ask you to please return. You were a putz when you were younger. So, I never thought of that being a bit. But, you know, so the directors were really the ones who did you in the camera angles and stuff like that. But it was written very well. You know, writers are really the underdogs of the world. They create everything. Directors, too. There are actors who get all the credit for everything. But, boy, a director tells you where to move and what to do and what you're feeling, and you get good lines. Boy, let me tell you something.
Well, how important was Leonard Stern to your career?
He was the kid. What do you mean, how important? That's a loaded question. What do you think you're talking to? No. How can I say? He was the most important thing that ever happened to me. I was making $1,200 a week when my father was trying to get to 100. That was tremendous. So money never mattered to me, though. I'm not the money type. It was always status. And, you know, funny, I used to say to myself, this is going to sound very morbid. Say, John, this is just the beginning. We're going to go from here. $1,200 a week will be like a pittance. We're going to move up. And then John once said to me, how about if this is the pinnacle? If we look back and say, remember when we used to be star? Come on, we laughed. Whoa. Hello there. I'm looking back at Dickens and Fenster saying, geez, if I only had that again. Okay, hurry up.
Well, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with the remarkable Marty Ingalls, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.